This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
G'day, this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, and we are broadcasting from the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people, and we offer our respects to them, their elders past and present. Before we get going, huge thanks to Jeff for another great edition of On The Record, and good on you for playing a bit of Mitski. Love that. Yeah, so cheers again. This is Indie Media. I'm Joni Boyd. I'm here with Brent. G'day, Brent.
How we going, Joni? Doing well?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I'm a bit nervous. I don't know why.
It's all good. We'll get through it together.
We will, and we've got a lot to get through today on the show. We've got Mariana Yorgabilia McKay chatting to us about Wednesday's Invasion Day rally down at Forest Chase. And we also have...
Yes, very typical of me. I want to come in and talk about forests again.
Got to talk about those trees.
We're talking to Jeremy, the Vice President from Save Our Jarrah. Very small local group of activists that are really taking up against American giant Alcoa.
Yeah.
Who are looking to expand their bauxite mining operations. By almost twofold, I think, from 2.5 million tons aluminium per year to 5.25 million tons.
And this is despite the McGowan government's recent supposed ban on logging and foresting.
Yeah, yep. The clause within that. I think a lot of people probably think the job's done. However, deforestation for mining is still well and truly on the cards. There's still a lot to fight for, and... The guys down at Save Our Jarrah and the Jarrahdale Forest Protectors are certainly on the front line with that one.
Bloody oath. And we'll have that one in just a moment. We also have Jesse Noakes coming into the studio from How's the Homeless WA and also a Indie Media contributor. He'll be giving us a rundown of last summer's Frio tent city situation and also homeless vulnerabilities to COVID with their vaccination rates only at about 40% at the moment. So there's a lot to get through today, and we'll have the Jarrahdale Forest Protectors in just a moment.
Now, Alcoa, as we discussed earlier, they're looking to expand their operations with a recent application to the Environmental Protection Agency. So we've got Jeremy, the Vice President of Save Our Jarrah, on the line. Jeremy, how are you going?
Good morning there. Going good, thanks. Jarrahdale Forest Protectors, that's the group.
Awesome, awesome. No worries. So Save Our Jarrah instead of Jarrahdale Forest Protectors, is the Save Our Jarrah just a bit of a name for the website that comes across that is you guys work with, or is it a separate entity?
Save Our Jarrah was the campaign name originally back in a few years ago when the Jarrahdale Forest Protectors were trying to stop some logging near Jarrahdale. But the group is the Jarrahdale Forest Protectors. Save Our Jarrah is the campaign name. There's a Facebook page with that same name. But it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. So what's been going on? Obviously, there's been an application to the EPA to extend the bauxite operations at the aluminium refinery as well as at the Huntly mine. Do you know what the status is with that at the moment?
Well, that's right. So in... 5 or 6 months into COVID in 2020, the Alcoa put forward their proposal to the EPA. And essentially what that will involve is a slight increase in production of alumina, so that will require more input of the bauxite at the refinery, but also to move the mine to two new areas. And one is southeast of Jarrahdale, and that goes right up to Jarrahdale, although I think the company might have made the boundary at Jarrahdale's edge for the reason of then being able to fall back and say, oh, we're taking into consideration your concerns, or if we've taken a hit, so give us the other bit. But that won't protect a lot of beautiful forest north of the Serpentine Dam and around the prisoner of war camp, as well as down towards the Monadox Conservation Reserve. And then, of course, for dwelling up for the south, there's a proposal there to also expand the mine. Now, of course, bauxite mining needs to constantly move because bauxite is thin, on a thin layer, maybe 4 metres, like 4 metres in depth. And so the mining gets through the ore. It's not like gold mining where you dig a hole down, or shaft mining. It actually chews up a lot of land area. So there's a proposal to go into Eastern dwelling up as well, about 5 kilometres from the town. And so at the moment, this proposal is before the EPA, but not quite yet. Alcoa are preparing their documents, and they will go to the EPA at some point in 2022 if the company doesn't let it lapse and the mining doesn't go into those areas. So, yeah, we're waiting for that from Alcoa for the EPA, and there'll be a two-month public comment opportunity, which is a good thing. And it's the first time for this issue that opportunity will be given to the public.
Mm. And obviously, you, when that does happen, you guys will push that out through social media and sort of start up another campaign to get some public engagement with that.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of our messaging has been to listen out to our announcement that is live if they don't come across that themselves. And definitely we'll be looking to put together a very sound response ourselves for the Jarrodale Forest Protectors.
So, Jeremy, sorry, mate.
No, you go.
What kind of response are you expecting from the EPA?
In return? So, well, I guess, I mean, the EPA has to be, they have to make an objective judgment on all things considered, environmental. I mean, there is obviously a lot of expectation going into this that Alcoa are going to want to get more access to ore. So hopefully that doesn't predetermine any outcomes. But I might expect, and we would expect, that the EPA will make a very sound assessment and take into consideration all the points that will be raised. And it very well may be the case that they say, no, it can't go ahead. But this is just speculation. So we'll have to wait and see.
Walking around those areas, obviously there's quite a lot of walking trails and recreational areas through that part of the Jarrah Forest with the Bibbulmun Track out towards Mount Cook, Mount Solace, all those areas. You really do see how bad the land is scarred after the bauxite strip mining, and you do see a lot of sort of failed revegetation processes. You yourself, Jeremy, I know you spend a lot of time in the bush, walking, hiking. What sort of big impacts do you really notice around these areas after Alcoa has gone through with their mining operations?
Well, obviously the mining operation requires the removal of the forest, and usually that's on the uplands or the side of a hill where the bauxite is, and that's where arguably the better Jarrah Forest grows. And so you've got these kind of pits in the ground. They're quite shallow. They call them pods. But anyway, the ground has been stripped back, and that eventually gets rehabilitated. You were talking about walking trails. So on the Bibbulmun Track along, kind of roughly along parallel to Albany Highway, you got Mount Randall and Mount Cuthbert and Mount Vincent, and then further south is Mount Cook. And I think a lot of Bibbulmun Track hikers have noticed, especially from Mount Vincent, looking to the southwest around Mount Solace, some very extensive strip mining, and that might be what you're referring to there. In terms of walk trails being interrupted where they are currently mining, there's not a whole lot of trails really, but there is a walk trail that goes to the top of Mount Solace. It's an off-track trail from the Walk GPS website, a fantastic website, I might add. And so that's behind the Alcoa gate, but people can still, or do still, hike it. I'm not sure what the jurisdiction is and the legalities are. It is still state forest. It was, the mined areas were never taken off the state forest list. So, I mean, recreation is one of the objectives of state forest. So, but yeah, so there's been some impact to that walk. But in regards to Jarrodale, the proposal to mine so-called Myara North, I don't know why it can't just be called Jarrodale East, or the Jarrahdale mine, it will be mining below Mount Vincent, closer than the current mining. And so for people on the Bibberman track looking down at the forest below, they will be able to see if this approval is given. And McGowan is the one who ultimately has final say, I think. And they're going to be looking down on mining below. So that will be an impact, let alone the impact to the forest itself, which is on to the southeast of Jarrahdale. And there are some walk trails through there that could well be impacted. But definitely, even if there's a buffer zone given to some trails, there'll be a sense that the forest has been hollowed out. So beyond the view of sight, there'll be a hollowness as a big void where mining has taken place or is taking place. And so, yeah, there are big impacts for the area. And that's why we're quite concerned. And we think that it's about getting a balance, and considering that alcohol mine north of Jarrahdale historically, and they've made their way from Dwelling Up all the way up to the Serpentine Dam, if they come in around the back of the Serpentine Dam, it's really going to shrink Jarrahdale's remnant surrounding forest. So...
So,
fair enough.
So, Jeremy, the McGowan government a couple months ago announced that they would put an end to the logging of state forests. How does this fit into that? Doesn't this go against that?
Well, it was about logging.
Right.
Well, it's before it gets mined, it gets logged. But McGowan was very clear. He did say the exceptions to this would be for mining. Like Alcoa, that's what he said.
Of course, yeah.
He did also say approved mining areas, and this hasn't been approved yet, so what we're talking about. It does seem inconsistent, and there's a lot of old foresters out there who are pretty dirty about this because they would argue that their logging is way more sustainable than bauxite mining, yet they've been given the boot, and the bauxite mining's seemingly been given a free pass. So, I think... It does raise those questions, and that is a good point.
Awesome. Thank you for your time today, Jeremy. Just before we go, you've got a little forest tour out that way people can take to check out a few different things
that
area. Do you want to tell us a bit about that and where you can find the map for that?
Absolutely. Well, the map can be found on the JarrahdaleForestProtectors.org website. It's called the Jarrahdale Forest Tour. It's a self-drive tour, so the idea is you take the map and you drive your own car through the bush on tracks, of course, and you can see a number of different things. So we tried to give a bit of an overview of unmined forest, unlogged forest, some Alcoa rehab from about 20 years ago, and some other features like the bank shears that grow in the area in the Shear Oaks, a big log, the old prisoner of war camp, which is down Balmoral Road. Beautiful country out there. It's some of the best Jarrah forest. And, then the tour comes back to Jarrahdale and then back out along Kingsbury Drive, which is a tourist drive, across the dam wall. So it's actually a really good tourist drive because you drive across the dam wall and then you get onto the other side, and that's where behind the Carnac prison you can see a lot of clearing. Although you don't get to see it as good as you do on Google Maps, though, that's where you really get an idea. But yes, that's a tour, and it can be accessed on the website. And it's good because it gets people out there, and I'm sure there's people who are going to fall in love with the forest along the way. Some beautiful tall Jarrah, got the Shear Oak bank shear, nice little grasses on the ground, and it's lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful forest out there with lots of beautiful critters like mainland quokkas and some nice black cockatoos and whatever else. So thank you very much for...
Wallabies, emus, all the above.
Thank you for all that you do, Jeremy, and keep up the good fight and good luck.
Thanks for having me on the program. Goodbye.
No worries. Thank you. Bye.
Jeremy from Jarrahdale Forest Protectors here on RTRFM 92.1. You are listening to the Indie Media Show. In just a moment, we'll hear from Marianne Yorgabilia McKay on Wednesday's Invasion Day rally.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
So on Wednesday, Aboriginal activists and their allies will gather in Forest Chase in the CBD for Invasion Day. A wide range of speakers and acts will speak to the true history of Australian colonisation, the ongoing genocide of First Nations, and the meaning of January 26th. Earlier this morning, I chatted to Marianne Yorgabilia McKay, one of the rally's organisers, to get a bit more about the action and what's involved. G'day, Marianne. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
Oh, no worries. So what's in store on Wednesday? What's happening down at Forest Chase?
So we're going to kick off at 12 o'clock. So we'll have a welcome to country. We'll have some of the mob doing some dancing. And then we'll kick off with Delson Stokes, one of our brother boys. His band, Yabu Band, they sing like I Love Noongar Music and all these other songs, deadly.
Beautiful.
So Dally's going to kick us off, yeah, yep. And then we'll get into the speeches and then other Noongar artists will perform during the event.
Yeah, great. And then will there be a march through town?
Yeah, so we'll go until 2:20, I think 2:20, 2:25, we'll march around the city. So we've got a route put up on the Perth Invasion Day event page on Facebook.
Yep.
So it'll just be a short route, probably take us 20 minutes to half an hour, and then we'll disperse at the front of the Birak Festival, our survival concert down at Supreme Court Gardens.
So things kind of keep going with some more music and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Birak Festival always goes off, you know, in a good way.
Yeah, for sure.
And so usually after the rally, we all usually hang out there. And then people who want to watch the Sky Show go to the fireworks and then others just go home. And the event usually finishes at 7:30, I think, with Birak.
Yeah, nice. What other speakers and acts have we got?
So we've got some elders speaking. So we've got like Uncle Hedley Haywood. We've got Sandy Davies from Geraldton. We've got Nawala, sister girl from Kununurra. We've got
great.
Some young ones like Kaya Watt, my 10-year-old Blanche, and another young one, Hayden Thorne. And then we've got myself, Megan Cracker, Herbert Profo, Derek Ryan, Uncle Warren Yorkshire, and I think that's it off the top of my head.
Fantastic. So, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, and I was just going to say, yeah, and then we've got other artists like Jason Broffo, Jamal Ryder, Natasha Eldridge, and Fluent, Joshua Eggington.
Yeah, you've got to have Fluent.
Do some performances. Oh, my God, yes. Yep.
So
he'll be the last performer.
Yeah, excellent. So why is it important for folks to get down on Wednesday?
Well, Invasion Day to us, you know, is a day of mourning. Mm-hmm. And it's about spreading the truth of what Invasion Day actually means to us as Aboriginal people. So you get people in society that don't truly understand the message of Invasion Day because it's not about black versus white. It's about us coming together to get the wider public to understand why we feel the way we do on what they know as Australia Day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the start of a genocide, a cultural genocide for our people, which has led to all the social justice issues that our mob go through today, you know. So, and it was just a really sad time for our mobs because, as we know, 26th of January, that's a national day. And in Perth, our Invasion Day was the 1st of June, 1829.
Yeah.
So, but we have the Invasion Day rally on the national day, you know, because that's when Australia, the Aboriginal people of Australia first was, you know, the whole dispossession started and the massacres and the whole downhill kind of spiral, I guess.
It's when it all started across the whole continent. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So a day of truth-telling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all we really want is, you know, you have some people want to abolish Australia Day and some people want to change the date of Australia Day. And they're both very valid arguments coming from Aboriginal people because people just think that you know, we need to abolish the whole date because Australia isn't even a country, you know, in national unity. It's still a colony, you know, which yep. operates as a business with all their governments. And then you've got the other argument where, yes, you know, Australia is a beautiful country to live. People should celebrate, you know, being an Aussie, you know, but at the end of the day, they shouldn't be celebrating, you know, being an Australian on a day that the cultural genocide of the first peoples actually started.
Yeah, so, not to editorialise too much, but, yeah, I don't think there's much to celebrate about this country.
Yeah, you know, that's right. And when you look, you know, like each successive government has not done what's right for the people, whether you're black or white, mm-hmm. to tell you the truth. You know, so there really needs to be some truth-telling process, you know, and where we can all come together and actually create something that's worth celebrating, you know. And what's worth celebrating is the survival of Aboriginal people, really, you know, when you look at the country and the fact that we have the oldest living culture in the world that has survived even though we've been impacted by genocidal policies, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Survived through everything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that's why some people call it Survival Day, because we've survived. So you've got Invasion Day, you've got Survival Day, but they both really carry the same sort of message, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Mm. Get down at midday in Forest Chase. There'll be a variety of speakers and acts commemorating the invasion.
Yep. And people just need to remember we've got to have our masks as well,
yes.
due to the government's announcement with what's going on.
Yep.
We've also got QR codes that we've put together, so they'll be on the pillars around Forest Chase. So people just need to check in as well,
yep.
which is important considering what's going on at the moment.
For sure.
And also water bottles. City of Perth will have a big water tank and stuff. So it's going to be a hot day, so people just need to make sure if they're going to come, just be prepared.
Yeah, wear a hat.
You know, and keep yourself hydrated. Yep, wear a hat.
Bring some sunscreen.
You know, yep, all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
Just make sure, yeah, because we don't want people to miss out because of the heat or the COVID, but we understand, you know, some people, you know, might not want to be in that situation because of the heat and because of the pandemic. So,
yep.
But we just encourage everyone. We've done what we have to keep everyone safe, so you know, it'll be good to see as many people as we can, you know, come and enjoy us and just listen, you know, to what the variety of speakers have to say and see some deadly Noongar acts perform as well, you know.
Hell yeah. We'll see you down there, Marianne.
Yep. All right. No worries.
Yep. Thanks for coming on the show. Cheers. You are listening to RTRFM 92.1, and that was Marianne Yorgabilia McKay talking to us about what is happening down at Forest Chase on Wednesday for the Invasion Day rally, starting off at 12 midday. See you down there. We've got time to squeeze in a chat with Jesse Noakes. So it's been a year since the McGowan government seized control of a tent city for rough sleepers down in Frio and kicked out its residents with no adequate long-term support. Here we've got Jesse Noakes from How's the Homeless WA and also a long-time indie media contributor to remind us of what happened in the camp and to talk about homeless vulnerabilities to COVID. G'day, Jesse. Thanks for coming in. I should probably turn your mic on.
Hey, Johnny. Hey, Brent. Great to be back in the studio.
Yeah, it's great to meet you.
Yeah.
So just give us a little bit of a background on the tent city, because it's been about a year since it was ended.
Yeah. So yesterday, I think, was exactly 1 year since the cops and government officials swarmed in and pulled down all the tents. I was actually passing by Pioneer Park in Frio yesterday and noticed that the grass has been left to die. It's a dusty yellow dust bowl down there, which is ironic because a lot of the fuss from the local council, at least at the time, was, oh, my God, the tents.
It's unsightly.
They're killing the grass. It's an eyesore. It's the gateway into Frio. And now you go down there and they clearly forgot to turn the sprinklers on this summer. So bigger fish to fry. The tent city down in Frio was only one of several that emerged last year. I think there's been long-term chronic crisis around homelessness and a lack of adequate public housing in WA, specifically or especially for the Aboriginal community and the families that we work with through House the Homeless WA, which is the campaign that was set up to kind of to platform and help support Aboriginal families experiencing homelessness. The camp in Frio emerged, I mean, it came together in the space of literally 2 weeks. There were two meetings in the run-up to Christmas last year, Boxing Day. We got down there about 6 a.m, set up a couple of tables, put up a gazebo, started handing out the hot coffee and tea and some fruit and some Christmas leftovers, and it just sprawled from there.
What kind of response did you get from Frio Council?
Oh, it was really mixed. I think initially, I mean, Frio Council were caught in a difficult spot. By the end of it, they had the full might of the McGowan government kind of breathing down their necks and ultimately sort of reaching over the top of them to pull it back into state control. There was a bit of a split between the elected councillors, many of whom I think were quite sympathetic to the plight of the people down there and really wanted to help sort of affect some systemic change and improvements. And then the non-elected council, the bureaucracy, I think just saw it as an absolute headache. They wanted to get rid of it as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, they found there was nowhere for these people to go. So they'd all kind of come together because there was a bit of support available over a very difficult, hot, intense time of year. And once they'd come together and there were 70 tents and 100 people camped in a park by Frio Station, it turned out, oh, shit, we've actually got nowhere to put these people. I wonder what they were doing in months and years gone by. No one had really thought to ask, and suddenly they were forced to.
It was a big... It was a big moment. Did the situation kind of develop out of COVID, like, and the issues with the economy that came out of it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think definitely in part. So sort of long term, there's been a long-standing crisis with homelessness in WA. I mean, the state government evicts 600 families from public housing every year. There's a public housing wait list that sort of balloons between 15 and 25,000 over the last decade or so. It's currently at 18,000, which is a 30% increase since Tent City was pulled down. So there's these chronic long-term issues, but then I think COVID really sort of, as it has done elsewhere, really amplified and accentuated and revealed sort of the cracks in the system already and the cracks that people were falling through. And the main thing about the WA government's COVID response was that unlike, in contrast to other states who got thousands and thousands of people off the streets in the first weeks of the pandemic and into hotels and motels, and then from there were able to actually transition a lot of them into long-term housing. So the pandemic, in some respects, was actually quite a net positive in terms of the homelessness response. WA did nothing. So I was on the COVID task force in March and April 2020 and watched them just sit in their hands, really. They got 20 people into a hotel trial that lasted a month and they all ended back up on the streets. And then over the course of the next year leading up to Tent City, the problem just sort of snowballed and increased. And the basic problem was there was no other people to go.
Seems to be a bit of a habit for this government sitting on its hands, like when it comes to public health and just kicking the can down the road.
Many have said it.
Speaking of which, you told us that the homeless population in the city is only around 40% vaccinated. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a chronic, deep-seated distrust of information that is provided by the authorities and by the government. I mean, as well as 40% being double vaccinated, around 40% of the homeless population are First Nations as well, and there are very, very, you know, chronic, eternal, entirely rational reasons that that community is deeply, deeply mistrustful of the government. In fact, I had a Balladong Whadjuk elder call me this morning, and I'm just going to quote something. I wrote down something she said to me. She said, "I feel fearful of the WA government, that our lives are at risk. It's sad we feel unsafe in our own country." And I think that deep-seated insecurity when it comes to the government explains part of the problem. I think the other part of the problem is that people just don't have the information they need. I got a text message from someone on the street last week saying, "Me and my partner desperately need to get vaccinated. Where can we do it for free?" And I couldn't even tell her. And if I don't know where people can go to get vaccinated, how on earth are people without phones in some cases?
Is there just a simple lack of a process or something from whichever government department that should be out there going, "Well, hey, we know X, Y, Z amount of people on the street. What's your vax status? Can we get, like, there's lots of, I see it every day when I walk through City of Frio, there's lots of little pop-up places.
For sure.
Food, health, whatever, you know, that obviously exists away from the government through charity or people out of their own goodwill. What Is there not someone who should be doing that?
Oh, there absolutely is. I think the WA Department of Health, the Department of Communities, West Australian Police and the credible service providers all have that responsibility and ought to be accountable on this one. I think it's just, as has always proven to be the case thus far, that unless they're confronted with the problem, they just forget about it. And as I was saying off air before, like, remote communities and WA's regions have quite rightly received a lot of attention and resources to ensure that the vaccination rates up there, which are still lagging, of course, but to ensure that everything that's possible is done to protect those communities. I think the WA government's just sleeping on the crisis on its own doorstep again. And I mean, we saw the whole crisis that emerged around Tent City last year was simply because the government is not accustomed to being confronted with the problem. Normally, people such as those we saw sleeping in tents last year are on the margins of society. We don't hear or see them. And for once, when the government had to actually listen to them and respond to them and discuss a problem that's largely of their own making, they really had no answers. And I think, yet again, they've been caught asleep at the wheel. The hard border delay may have pushed the can down the road a little bit, but the Omicron cluster kind of continuing to grow suggests it might be a moot point.
Yeah. With Omicron starting in Perth, and this low vaccination rate for the homeless, what do we think might happen to these communities?
Well, I mean, in principle, they're a super spreader waiting to happen. Yep. I mean, let's not kind of mince our words. These people are out on the streets in large numbers, a highly transient community with no capacity to isolate, no chance to distance, very little access to protective equipment like masks or hand sanitizer or whatever it may be. If someone gets sick, they're not going to get tested.
Yeah. They're not checking into places because how could they?
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, the vaccine mandate that's due to come in next week is another question that remains unanswered. How people on the streets are supposed to comply with that is anyone's guess, I think, at this point. Yeah, I think it's a very, very, it's a perfect storm, and it's a kind of a grenade that's waiting to go off potentially. And I think someone ought to do something.
So it's like not even just about protecting these homeless communities themselves. It's also a massive risk to the population in general because of this super spreader nature.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, for whether one's concern comes from a place of empathy and altruism and respect for people who are doing it tough generally for very, very long-standing systemic reasons through no fault of their own, or whether you simply see it as an inconvenience and a problem that needs to be fixed for the sake of wider society, we've got to get onto it quickly because, for all we know, it could be out there already. And we kind of narrowly averted a catastrophe in the early weeks of the pandemic. I think, in spite of almost 2 years to prepare on this issue, as with the wider health crisis, the government's got a lot of questions to answer, and they ought to come up with some answers pretty quick.
Absolutely. So to start wrapping things up, our listeners, where can they find your org, and how can they help your efforts?
Oh, that's a good question. I think we got a website, www.howsthehomelesswa.org. We tend to kind of try and stay in the background as much as possible, so there's lots of media that will be coming out kind of in coming weeks around the vax rates, around the campaign more broadly. So, you know, have a read of some of those if you come across them. And I think just sort of, as always, it's just, as we saw down at Tent City, the community is very, very receptive and sympathetic and really rallies around. We had hundreds of volunteers down there for a month in the burning heat in that park over Christmas and New Year last year. And I think just kind of just continuing to, you know, be open and engaged and trying to do what we can and treating people as human beings, each and every one of us.
Excellent. Thank you, Jesse, and thanks for what you do.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we'll start wrapping things up. This has been the Indie Media Show. I am Joni, and I've been here with Brent. You know, cheers to everyone who was on the show today. In a moment, you'll hear from Rian Todd Hunter for Out to Lunch. Great to see her back in the studio. But as we always say here on Indie Media, don't hate the media.
Become the media.
Yeah, do it. You can do it too.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?